Hello and welcome to the 9th episode of Raczej Konsolowo Gamecast. I've decided to do the intro also in English, as the whole episode will be in English, so it doesn't make sense to have the intro in a different language. And today I'm gonna be joined by Archipel, which is a group that is doing documentaries and just video content on YouTube about Japan, about content creators from Japan, in very, I would say, different and broad industries, coming from either ramen restaurants, anime creators, manga drawers, animators, and of course game developers. And that's what I'm mostly interested in, that also that drove me to them. I'm very happy they've decided to join me. We talk a lot about their work, what they are doing, then we jumped into the Japanese game developer scene, of what is happening there, and we finish off by also discussing indies, of how's the state of indie development in Japan, and we finish off with just a few sentences, few questions about games that we are looking forward to coming from Japan. And also Archipel is telling us some of the games that he looks to the most when thinking about recent years. So that's it for the episode. I hope you're gonna be enjoying it, and yeah, let's kick off. Okay, so without any further ado, I would like to say hello and a massive thank you to my guest today, which is kind of strange because I'm inviting a YouTube channel that I don't know much about, if it's just, I would say, one person or a group person, but my guest today is Archipel, a YouTube channel that is creating documentaries about, I would say, people from Japan, creators from very say different and a lot of industries in Japan. So hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And maybe at the start you could introduce yourself to the audience a bit, tell the listeners something more about you, where do you come from, and what do you do for a living, and if that is actually Archipel or anything else.
Sure. So we create a channel named Archipel. Well, we pronounce it Archipel because we comes from French, and we're keeping the French pronunciation. So as you put it, it was very correct in the sense that we make documentary content about Japanese creators and artists. So we're a team of foreigners based in Japan. So Archipel started originally with a program named Tokotoko. Which was a series that was made for a French TV channel originally. So it was one person making it for French TV, and how things evolved is that that person was looking for additional structure and help, both financially and logistically. So the team slowly formed like this, where in the end we became a three-people team, where we kept on creating the Tokotoko series that was airing on both French TV. Then we started a YouTube channel because we wanted to extend the scope and also be able to showcase that content in other countries than France as well, so with English subtitles, etc. So we kept on going for a couple of years on that format that was more, well, TV variety kind of oriented. So if people access the channel, they'll see that the first videos are have an opening with a narration at the beginning, so it's much more like a TV format, you know. But we wanted to keep improving the quality of what we were doing and orienting ourselves more towards a documentary format. So Trigger was somewhere around the Suda 51 episode, so focusing on game creator Suda 51, where we completely switched formats, and we kept the name Tokotoko. We came the concept, which is Japanese creators and artists introducing the places that inspire them, or places they like in Tokyo. Also, we did a few episodes outside of Tokyo as well. But we switched formats into making it something that's more documentary-oriented and having more the guest become the narrator of the piece, and more have that documentary approach where the guest is opening his door to their universe, basically. So this is still something that kept evolving. So we always remained a small team. So we always tried new things, some things that worked better, some things that worked less. Like, for example, when we switched to the documentary format, it we had some gray titles and emotion because, yeah, we did with what we could. We don't have a motion graphic designer. So we don't have, like, an animator for that kind of stuff. We always kept that small organic approach to it. That team actually from three people, we're now two people managing the channel. So basically what happened is at some point the Toko Toko series, we took it to an end as well. It was last year in June, where our last episode was featuring the Nier series composer Keiichi Okabe.
Yeah.
And at that time already we had changed the channel name to Archipel, because we wanted to do more diverse content, go outside of the scope of Toko Toko, try new concepts in new formats as well.
Mm-hmm.
And which slowly takes us to where we are today. So we're still a very small team. We're not a big production company that has infinite resources in creating content, but we still keep that organic approach, and with the main objective of showcasing Japanese creators, Japanese artists, and their work to overseas audience.
Great.
Should I make it shorter?
Yeah, that was, I would say, a very good introduction. Also, you kind of hit the first question from the audience, but I would like to take a step back and just to clarify. So now you the Archipel, I would say, team is two people, and are you both from France?
Yes, we're two French people based in Japan. Yes.
Okay, so you're both from France. So you're actually I had in my career as a podcaster, three interviews with foreign, I would say, guests, and you're the second French guest, because the first one was, I don't know if you know him, a painter, a digital painter called Orioto, and he paints I would say digital pictures of from based on video games and stuff like that. So and he also has a Patreon. so he was my first French guest. So I'm lucky to talk with French people, I guess. And yeah, so is, I would say, Archipel. I know that it was probably founded by the French television, right? When it started, when it was still Toko Toko.
Yeah, that's in the very, very early beginnings. But basically, when I say that we had to build a team by bringing structure and bring financial and logistic help, that's when we actually became fully self-funded.
Mm-hmm. And you do it through Patreon, right? So that's what I wanted to a bit advertise here already at the start. The link to the Patreon will be, of course, in the show description.
Thanks very much. Yes, so we do indeed have a Patreon, which we are very bad at managing. We launched it last year. It's a small effort into getting some funding from the community as well. But to be fully transparent on the current status, is that most of the channel is still self-funded, and what we do is we have side jobs on our end, where we produce videos both in the industry, like gaming or edition, and other jobs that are less interesting.
Okay, so I think one of the examples was, I think, something that I couldn't locate on your channel, because I was recently looking on it, because I remember I also was watching it, but I couldn't then find it, on the production of Nioh 2. Nioh 2, I think it was, it's outside of the Archipel channel. You did it, I think, for some gaming website or for television.
Yes, so for the Inside Nioh 2 documentary, this more than a commission project, it was more than of a collaboration with a Japanese gaming web media here named GameSpark. And the goal of this collaboration was actually to have a more in-depth type of content, where we could couple both what we did in a documentary format in video with the content made by the GameSpark editorial team. So basically, what happened is, in addition to the 1 hour documentary that that we produced, there is also a very in-depth article on the Games Park website that describes, adds a bit more info and insight to the content. So more, this wasn't really a financial collaboration more than it was an editorial collaboration.
Yeah, so moving forward with the discussion, and I will now go to the first question that came out of, I would say, a form that I've sent out to the public just to maybe collect some questions from the audience and from people just all around my Twitter reach, if they have any questions for you guys. And I initially wanted to have them at the end, but they are so tied into what we are discussing and what also I wanted to know that I just added them inside the conversation. So the first one was, so for you to talk a bit more about the transition from Toko Toko to Archipel and the things you guys have learned doing this work for, I would say, the past few years. You kind of said, I would say, already a bit about the transition, but what are, I would say, are there any, I would say, key learning points that you guys like learned from the Toko Toko and now are continuing?
More than learning points, I can go a bit into more detail about the transition from Toko Toko to Archipel. So basically, as I said, Toko Toko was an ongoing series that had that went under a certain number of changes itself. But at some point, we wanted to be more broad in the terms of the content we're creating. So the approach we're taking, the concepts as well, the people we're featuring, and also the formats too. So we did the switch to Archipel. It was in March 2018, I believe, where we had another concept that we started in addition to Toko Toko, which was named New Territories, which was which still is content that focuses on a French artist and his artistic journey here in Japan. And from that point, when we did the switch to Archipel, we wanted to try our hand at doing more concepts. So this ended up in us doing content about food, board games. We did a longer documentary in 2018 named Ebb and Flow, which was focusing on the resurgence that we saw in the Japanese game industry between 2016 and 2018, which was a longer format where we talked with eight game creators who told us their views on how the game industry evolved this past few years and how we reached that point where we really saw a really strong momentum in how the Japanese industry reflourished. At that point, we also, while the Toko Toko series was still running, we kept doing that type of additional content. So we did like a smaller, shorter content as well. Then in 2019, we kept on going. We did some creator portraits that didn't really enter the scope of Toko Toko because it didn't have that, it didn't enter that concept of people introducing places. It was more of an in-depth portrait. Then last year, summer, we did another long-form documentary about the Dreamcast. Yes. So for the Dreamcast 20th anniversary, what the approach we took is look at some of the creators from the console's most innovative games, I would say, where we discuss their views on the console, the industry at the time, what made it that the Dreamcast wasn't full on commercial success, and it had its life shortened to a mere 2 years and a half-ish before being discontinued. So basically, my point is, doing the transition to Archipel really extended the scope of content we could create. So it basically opened a bunch of new approaches. It allowed us to try new things creatively as well. So
Because you guys were kind of
learning, yes.
Because you were kind of like free of the boundaries, right? That you guys set for yourself for the series.
Exactly. So, well, the fact that we're on solely on YouTube, we're a small team, we're self-funded, means that we have no boundaries, really, to be honest. So, the only boundary we were fixing ourselves is what we were doing under the Tokotoko concept scope. So, once we decided we could also try our hand on new content, yeah, it basically opened up even more possibilities, and that's how we tried out our hand at doing all those types of new content.
Yeah, so I think the movie was called, you already said the title, Ebb and Flow, I think, the documentary about the Japanese creators and discussing the generational, I would say, difference of what was happening in the past generation of consoles and now, and how the Japanese industry is handling now and then. And I think that was the starting point for me for watching your content and your videos. And I went then back to the Tokotoko series and just watched it on your channel. And I haven't watched everything, just to be clear, because I usually watch like documentaries or stuff about games on YouTube when I'm doing something else, like work or something like that, or I'm just listening to stuff. That's also a lot of what is happening. And your videos are demanding, I would say, from me to actually sit there and read the text, because they are fully Japanese without, I would say, any voice in English or in any other language. So they are a bit more demanding. That's why when I sit down to a video from Archipel, I just like sit down, basically be, I would say, fully concentrated and calm, and that actually helps me digest the videos, because it's the perfect atmosphere for receiving them, I would say, because that's actually also something that I really, really appreciate of how you guys are doing. It's that the videos that Archipel is creating are, kind of say, are very calming. They are they focus very much on the people and their, I would say, experience, their feelings, and what is inspiring them. That's kind of different in compared to let's say NoClip, what they are doing, but what is similar also between also you guys and NoClip is the production value. And that's, I would say, the second thing that I wanted just to brought up, that it's for me personally insane how good the takes are that you guys are taking from, I would say, just and landscape and photographic point of view of what are, I would say, the angles and the takes that you guys take whenever you just talk about, I don't know, a ramen restaurant or someone like Yoshitaka Amano, the Final Fantasy art creator. I have still in my head the take when you just like record him from the top when he's just lying on the ground and painting something like very freely. He looks also very calm and completely not aware of someone being filming him while he's doing his stuff. So that those images kind of stuck to me, and it's something different. It's completely different from what I see in other documentaries doing. So my next question would be that, okay, the Tokotoko episodes are a bit, I think, 10 to 15 minutes long, but how long do you guys spend on actually producing stuff like on this quality of video?
Really depends, actually. But yeah, to give more a quick overview of the process, is that we would start by contacting the guests and first have a discussion on the type of places they would be able to introduce. Also discuss a bit on how we would conduct the interview, and really spend a bit of time on doing that pre-production process. We would plan and schedule and see how we can handle things logistically in terms of how we move between places, etc. And obviously discussing the places, also like discussing with the guest on to what level they want to showcase these places. You know, some people in the past they were more private, you know, so asking us yeah, maybe not go that way. Mm-hmm. But still, yes, it would be first an exchange with the guest or the people representing him, and then we would shoot. And after that, it would be really focusing on how to build up the piece from there. You know, so duration is very, very variable, because you mentioned you say episodes are from 10 to 15 minutes long, but actually the more the series advance, the episodes, some episodes go way longer. Mm-hmm. Too. So towards the end, you can see that we're getting closer to 20 minutes. And then, for example, we did like our last episode with Keiichi Okabe, for example, is close to 40. Yep. I think, you know, so basically it's look at the content we have and how we can put it together and still have something that's, of course, watchable and that we feel comfortable with. And yes, that's there's not really a manual of process on how we make an episode. It would be more like I think this is also close to our organization we have, which is like take things like very organically, you know, like being small, you know, it would be like, okay, maybe try this, maybe try that. Like it's always like, yeah, looking at the material we have and see what we can make with it, you know?
Yeah, so I especially said the Toko Toko episodes because they are, like you said, those 10 to 15 minutes. Well, at least most of them, because yeah, the Okabe episode was really long. And yeah, but I cannot imagine the amount of work that you guys put into to get this quality level, which is enormous. To get it to that level. You also kind of briefly attached to the next question that I've got from the audience, which is, and I will basically just read it out loud. How do you find the people that you introduce in your movies? Are they people you've already met, or are they just artists that inspire you and you decided to contact them for creating video? Did you receive any rejections about making a video? And I'm not quite sure you can tell us about the rejections. Probably that's not something for the public. But yeah, just how do you pick and choose, I would say, the people?
Okay. Yes, so to answer yes that part of the question first, we would first discuss who would like to feature, who would be interested in to knowing more about, and from there it's gonna depend on how we get in touch with the people. So sometimes we would have a direct contact, which is obviously the best case scenario, but sometimes it's not the case. It would be like going through a person we know that who might maybe get us in contact with a guest. Some other times it would be getting in contact with the company directly. So, for example, say you have a game creator who works for a said company, we would get in touch with the PR department and see what's possible to achieve in terms of content. So yeah, it really depends on the method of contact. So obviously, the further we advance, we get to know more people who know more people. So sometimes it opens up new doors, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's very tough to get some doors open. I'm thinking, for example, we look at the requests we get from viewers too, in terms of creators to feature, and sometimes we'll be very keen to feature them as well, but we do get some limitations, and I'll get to the rejection point you mentioned as well. So for example, I'm thinking animation content is sometimes hard for us to put in place, because when you want to feature, let's say, an animation director, right? You want to show some of their work, and that work would be licensed, and you would need to pay a financial compensation in order to use those materials, which makes it hard for us, you know, as a small team and with limited financial resources, you know. So that would be one bottleneck we would see from time to time. Also, in terms of actual rejection, I don't like really saying rejection. It's more like, well, some logistics that make it hard for us to move forward is that sometimes, like for Tokotoko, the guests would be very private and would like to avoid showing like places that go too much to that private realm. Sometimes it would be time constraints. So I'm thinking, for example, manga artists and some illustrators as well who work on tight deadlines, you know, and don't have really time to do like also a full-on interview plus going to shoot on location and that kind of stuff. So time and scheduling is a constraint as well. Sometimes it could be there could be restrictions with the companies, you know, like, saying
normal stuff.
This doesn't fall in our promotion schedule or that kind of stuff. So rather than full-on rejection, like no, I don't want to go in your content, it's more like logistic issues that makes it that sometimes we cannot move forward. Yes.
Yeah, so I don't imagine anyone rejecting your invitation based on your work because it's always very good, and I would say very because you talked.
Well, it's not what I'm saying. Maybe they're just not saying that directly and just using that as the schedule as an excuse. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe because what some of your videos are very, I would say, private. And what I mean is that that's also something that I really like, because one episode that I have here in my mind was also the Koji Igarashi and Yohei Kataoka interview, and that was also very nice because it. The videos are cut and the whole documentary is cut in a way that is very, I would say, it doesn't even kind of look like that you guys are there, because it's like just two content creators, like developers, sitting in a bar just drinking and eating very freely and having a great discussion between them, and you are just there, I would say, recording. And that's also how I feel, like I'm just being there. I'm not, I would say, interfering with what they are talking. They also don't even for a split second look into the camera or anything. So by the way, is this, I would say, kind of agreed with them, or do you tell them to be this freely and naturally about it, or do you have to tell them don't look to the camera, or is this something that comes in naturally?
So so you brought up the discussion between Koji Igarashi and Yohei Kataoka. So yes, that's an example. The actual like creator is going out and sharing a drink and discussing is something we have done on some other content as well, like both Tokotoko episodes and some others too. So I would say it's something that's quite fascinating for us with Japanese guests and Japanese creators, is that they all tend to act very naturally in front of the camera. So obviously at the beginning, yeah, we'd have a small talk, like say, okay, you guys just go ahead and discuss like you would had a regular meal or regular dinner, you know. And most of the time, yes, it would go very smoothly, you know, like they would almost forget we're actually here and recording that, and it tends to go very, very smoothly. And I can't really recall of having like
You have to direct
a moment
people.
Where yes exactly.
Yeah, so that's was also fascinating for me, and what again makes the videos very special. So a question that I wrote down here, and it was after the Goichi Suda episode, because we and other gamers that are interested in his work kind of know what kind of personality that is, and how he is. And you also recorded a video for him that he was, I think, with his two colleagues from Grasshopper, yes, also like having a drink and eating and talking very freely. So my question that popped into my head was immediately, how do you even approach someone like Goichi, I would say Suda, to have an interview? And are you intimidated by some of the guests when you actually meet them?
Okay, so I'll answer from the from the last question. In the I wouldn't say we're really intimidated with the guest we feature. So I don't. It's funny that you're bringing up Suda Goichi, because in my impression, when we got to discuss and talk, it was really like having a conversation with a regular person. You know, it's just we get to discuss through the interview and also outside the interview during the shoot, you know, and it gets really casual. So I don't think there's any tension or intimidation or stress whatsoever, you know. So usually it goes quite smoothly on that front. So but yes, I can of course think of examples where we were a bit more nervous before approaching the content or before getting to meet the person, you know, like some examples that pop up to mind. It can be, let's go back to the ebb and flow piece, right? Mm-hmm. So we had an interview with Toshihiro Nagoshi, so who created the Yakuza series.
Of course.
And that interview was maybe a bit more stressful for us because we had less time to set things up, and also we had a really limited time together. And Toshiro Nagoshi is obviously like visually quite impactful, you know. So we remember we're setting up, and we feel like this presence suddenly in the room, where we feel like this aura suddenly. He's very tall too, so it's quite intimidating from that front. And at that point we're like, okay, we got a little bit more stressed, I admit that. Mm-hmm. And but in the end things went out great, and we got to interview Nagoshi-san again, like for example at TGS, and things would go really smoothly, you know. But yes, that first encounter I would say was a bit more intimidating. Also maybe another one that would come to mind would be when we shot with Katsuya Terada, mm-hmm, so the illustrator, where we did the concept here, the approach we took is that we went to spend 4 days on Iki Island, which is an island in the western side of Japan, so close to a big city named Fukuoka. Also, that island itself is very close to Tsushima, which is getting a lot of attention right now with the Ghost of Tsushima game. We were a bit intimidated here in the sense that it was something that was very new for us, you know, mm-hmm, because we were going to spend like four full days with the creator, you know. So it was really a whole new type of immersion for us. So waking up in the morning, going for breakfast, then following, going together to shoot, look at him draw, taking breaks, talking, going for dinner, night, then repeat, and also really have that, also being in a place that none of us were really familiar with. Mm-hmm. So it was quite interesting, I would say. And I think, I wouldn't place it as intimidating, but yeah, it was, we're a bit nervous of how things would turn out at the beginning, but slowly, again, it went very smoothly, and it's a really great shoot memory.
I would say the next part of the discussion would be just, I would say, game dev in Japan. Okay, so the first one that I would like to pick up now here is, one thing that struck me in videos about the individuals behind games is in Japan, in how they describe their days, I would say, and in short, mm-hmm, it's like working from morning till night. So that's also... it's happening in a lot of videos when you follow the developers, I would say, when they start their work in the morning and they are leaving the company, and it's already, I would say, very, very, very late. So is this like something that is happening normally in Japanese game for Japanese game developers? Do those persons have families or how I wrote it here, life outside their jobs?
Okay, so I think
is it really how it looks that they are spending their whole time, I would say, at their jobs?
So I think as far as the gaming industry is concerned, so we've been lucky enough to see to go into offices of many companies and talk to many creators. So yeah, I guess we got a wider perspective on that aspect. So what we saw is obviously, in a game for the later phases of development, before turning gold and having to finish the game, things do get busy, absolutely. So I think there is a certain extent of crunch time in many game companies when it comes to that specific phase of development. Now, not only in the game industry, it's something that's present here that we see in industries animation comes to mind specifically, where it can become very, very intense working hours and work durations. I think yes, it comes at phases. It's something that it's also being more regulated than it was before because of the global context and things that have been happening overseas as well. Bad news here we've had in Japan too with overwork and people working definitely too much hours, which ended up in health issues and sometimes even worse, So there is some kind of regulation that is starting to apply in Japan as well. But I think that, it would depend on the phases of work. And yes, rebound on your question of do these people have lives or anything? Yes, obviously, yes, they have lives too. And it would really depend on the context around them. Yeah, it would sometimes, I guess, things can get more intense.
Yeah, because that's just, I would say, a glimpse that I took away from the videos that you guys are creating. And also that is, I would say, as an example that was surprising for me is that I didn't know that Hideo Kojima, I would say, has a family and even kids and etc. Just up until, I would say, really recently I read it somewhere, so I also was not aware of that. So that kind of showed me that, okay, yeah, it's just that they are not bringing their families up front as it sometimes is happening in the West and documentaries in the West, because people talk very freely about their families and stuff like that when they are describing their work. I have in mind here the documentary about the God of War creation, and Cory Barlog was saying very freely there that about his relationships with his family during the development.
True. Yeah.
So I was very curious.
Yeah, I've seen the documentary as well, and yeah, it indeed strikes as a difference, which can also tell us a bit more that Japanese creators are maybe a bit more private on that aspect and really not showcasing that layer of their personal life. So, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily
not happening at all.
Non-existent, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, and you also kind of, I can imagine when we first discussed having us, I would say, for the interview, because the question about crunch here is particularly from a point of time last year that was, the topic was very, I would say, loud in the industry, but it is very loud at the, I would say, in the West. There is a lot of discussion going around about crunch and companies, I would say, exploiting their developers. Is the situation same in Japan? If so, why isn't there anything, I would say, coming out of the to the masses? And there is a myth that we have here, I think, in Europe and in general outside of Japan, and especially I know it, that it's kind of normal in Japan to work those, I would say, very late hours. And there's also like a legend that people in Japan don't like to take, I would say, days off. because they want to work. That's what I would say. How we think how the situation is in Japan. And you've been talking to a lot of developers, and maybe not, I would say, names even like Goichi Suda, but some smaller developers working at their studios. So, what's your take? Does Japan also have the problem of, I would say, exploiting developers and crunch and etc.?
I think that there is, as I said, there are obviously like crunch phases in Japanese game companies, and that it's something that was maybe even more intense in the past. Now what we see, we don't see a big debate on crunch, like as far as the gaming industry only is concerned. So we don't have like a really strong scandal in the Japanese gaming industry of lengthy working hours or crunch phases. But yeah, it's something that we start seeing in other industries. I took the example of animation. And in as far as gaming is concerned, yes, there are still those crunch phases do exist, but I think it's more of a there is an understanding with the developers as well that well, they need to there's a deadline with a game they're trying to finish and to achieve. So I guess the fact that it doesn't come out as much is that there is a more of an understanding here that it's something that kind of comes with
the process, right? And how it looks like. Because also, to be very much clear here, it's I'm like in the minority of people that say that actually crunch is not, I would say, avoidable at 100%, because I believe that even you as a content creator and me, I would say also that, well, I have a small blog and a podcast. I also know what it's like to you are so passionate about what you are doing that you want to put in a bit of, I would say, extra hours to what you were supposed to do or what should be there for you to, I would say, take something that extra step. And what is missing is just, I would say, the understanding part of just how I see what's happening in the West is the understanding between, I would say, the developers and the producers and the leads and etc. So why we are here in this spot, why did it come to this that we need to put those, I would say, late hours? And I just think that it is not completely avoidable, and I will tackle it, I would say, now personally, because from 2 weeks I started working as a producer at a game developer studio in Poland. So
congratulations.
Thank you. So I will tackle this topic hands on of is it really completely unavoidable and etc. and stuff like that. But I just wanted to like kind of know what is the myth happening, and it also might be that, well, in the West it's coming, I would say, a lot easier because, well, like we said, the companies and the people are more open to talk about, I think, their personal feelings and like them being tired and stuff. And like you already said, in Japan, people are just kind of a bit closed on those topics, tend to keep them to themselves and not talk about them. But another topic that I've seen, I would say, which is kind of strange or different compared to the Japanese game developer industry and the West, is something that I call the cult of personality. And this topic was brought up very loudly during Death Stranding, and Hideo Kojima like tweeted, I think, once that he does a lot on the Death Stranding developer. Don't know if you have seen that tweet, and people are very vocal.
Which made switch a bit the approach after that, where you started to see more pictures of the team and that kind of stuff. We saw that.
Yeah, and also the people are very, I would say, vocal about that part, but I also kind of started thinking about it, that there is something like in Japan that we are seeing the same names through I would say very long period of years, like Shinji Mikami or Nomura, and stuff. There are people that been in the industry I would say for all my life, and I don't see any I would say aspiring like new developers come up. Like it is in the West, because the whole indie scene is a bit also different. That's a second question. But coming back to the cult of personality, is it? How do you see it? How do you approach, I would say the topic in Japan?
Okay, so we have to take more as a perspective the second part of your question, where you mentioned that we always kind of see the same names popping up like for the past years, which is true in a way. I agree with you on that aspect, where we see a generation of game creators who are now entering their 50s, so a generation born in 1970, with people like Keiichi Toyama, Yoko Taro, Fumito Ueda, who are both the same age. There's also people who are slightly older, who are like you mentioned Kojima, Nagoshi, Mikami, too. I think we have first to think why that generation is on the forefront in the first place, because I think it's a generation that started to work on video games in the 90s, and it's the really first generation that who became game creators, because they discovered games at a young age, you know. So and then they started in the 90s, became creators, and got their names out there, and kept on working on titles. And now what we see is what I can see as part of the reason we still only mostly see those names is that it takes more and more budget for a company to create games. So for a company, a new game means a big investment, which means a risk in a way, obviously. So when you take a risk as a company, you want to most likely go with a safer bet as a director, as a producer, you know. So this is one part of the of my take on this. Also, there is maybe a less engagement from younger developers to really try to take the lead and say, okay, look, I'll try to take control of this project, or I'll pitch a new project and I'll put myself in the forefront for this. Even though it's something that we slowly see changing. So I think with younger directors like Fumihiko Yasuda, who's the director from Nioh, who's in his late 30s.
Yeah.
Or Takai Sataura, who's also in his 30s, who made his first game as a director last year with Astral Chain. I think we slowly see a shift on that aspect, but because a shift that is definitely necessary, because obviously there will be a need at some point to really like do a generation shift in directors and producers. But yeah, I would say that the main reason we still see big names on the forefront is because of
risk,
the companies and the risk that is attached to it. But yeah, things are still changing in a good way, I think.
Yeah, but also I think it's just the visual part of it, right? When we are here in Europe, when you attach a name like Nomura to something, we know who that is. We know his, I would say, portfolio and his legacy behind him. So we kind of tend to be more excited about stuff then. But you were talking more about the, I would say, the AAA scene and stuff. And I wanted to briefly just talk about the indie scene in Japan, because in the West it is very, I would say, like fruitable and just profiting right now. There are tons of new good developers, small developer studios popping up each day, basically. We've got really great content creators coming out of them, like something that pops into my head now is Rami Ismail or Mike Biffle, and guys like that. And also, we hear about small initiatives in bigger studios. Like, I think it was, it's called the RPG Factory, or what's the, it's a small studio within Square Enix, right? I think they created I Am Setsuna.
So
but there are small initiatives created by big companies, right? But what is the state of the indie scene in Japan? How is it doing?
So I think yes, there is definitely an indie scene here in Japan that's developing, and it's just it's coming from a different place, I think, because in the past, well, something that still exists today is something called the doujin scene, mm-hmm. where people would make games as a hobby with not a real commercial intent behind them,
mm-hmm.
and would showcase these in events like the Comic Market, so, which is a biannual event that gathers hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. And so people would see many people who we label as indie going more into that doujin scene, you know. So I think the indie label, like we take it mm-hmm. from our perspective, is something that really comes from the West, you know, is something that came a bit later through the success of indie games we've seen in the West, and it's still consolidating right now in Japan, and kind of coming on top of what was existing through the doujin scene. So as I said, like a doujin would be something like really as a hobby, you know, like mm-hmm. One person, two people would make and not really try to sell it or not really try to have any commercial intent there. But things are evolving now, so there is a big event in Kyoto named Beat Summit that is really focusing solely on the indie game scene and mm-hmm. showcases many indie game creators. There are also new initiatives put in place. One I can think of is actually one person who used to work with us as, at Archipel is now working for a community space named Asobu, which mm-hmm. is focusing on helping indie game creators in Japan into getting a bit more organizational and help. So in mm-hmm. order to help them better communicate, also
expose their work also, right?
True, and find publishers as mm-hmm. well. And also, Asobu is also trying to launch event initiatives, you know, to have people discuss about their games and also exchange on information how they can really get more of their initiatives out there too. So I would say that, yeah, there is absolutely an indie game scene here. It is different because of a different background it has, but it's slowly evolving, and it's currently there are more and more initiatives around it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it kind of it's normal for me to just see someone like splitting out from a big studio and just creating something by themselves in the West. That's happening, I would say, from time to time. And also you hear those like success stories like let's say Stardew Valley. I don't know the creator then, mm-hmm. but that's also like one of those stories of someone just creating stuff by himself and having a big success. But it's for a country that I say that is very much like has games in their bloodline. I mean mm-hmm. Japan, you don't hear like a lot of going outside of Japan in terms of the indie scene and any studios that are happening there. The example that I have in my head is actually Hironobu Sakaguchi creating his own I think studio after moving away from Square Enix. That's also something that that I just thought about. But it seems like, because we are like coming to an end of the game dev discussion, it seems that a lot of is changing from what you said. First of all, in terms of the working hours and just work-life balancing. Also, I see that you told me that there's something happening there. The government is like putting some regulations. Also, that's definitely good. Also, there's
I think the current context with COVID-19 is also changing a lot in the process of companies and game development One big addition that comes to mind is remote work for game companies is something that wasn't that much in place until COVID-19 hit us, but now it kind of forced game companies into taking that step and implementing ways for developers to work remotely too. So yeah, it's another kind of forced change, I would guess.
Yeah, of course, we're now living, I would say, in a moment of the world that is so impactful on a various I would say parts of our life and the industry and work, that some things go bad, some things pop up and change. So it's I would say definitely you could describe it as, I would say, as a very significant moment in our, I would say, life living here in all countries. Yeah, but of course, like, working remotely, that's something that is changing right here. Companies that didn't even think about the possibility of allowing their employees to work from home now change their mind because they see, well, they were forced to it, but they see that this actually can be done. So definitely that's also something that has an, I would say, an impact on it. And the last thing we discussed is just the change about the personalities in companies. You said that it's now also from your perspective changing a bit. It's like small developers or smaller names are popping up and being more visual, and the indie scene is also happening and growing. So that's definitely good. I cannot wait to see what's gonna be happening in a few years and how this all will evolve in Japan. But now moving away from, I would say, the game developers and etc. So talking more personally, as you know, we are Raczej Konsolowo, and that is my blog. It's very heavily gaming related. So I just wanted to ask you: do you even play any games? Do you have time for playing games?
Yes, we play games, and it's both a passion we have. I mean, both of us in the team, we've been playing games since we're kids, and we still do. Now it's also, of course, since we do a lot of stuff with game developers, we have to stay updated, and we have to play as well. I wouldn't say that playing games is part of our work, because it would be definitely exaggerating. We still enjoy playing games, and yeah, we still find the time to play.
Okay, that's great. So my next question actually is valid, because I wanted to ask you, what are your, I would say, favorite Japanese games this year so far? And I wrote this question in 2019, which was a, I think, bigger year for Japanese titles. So maybe just to say this more broadly, what are, I would say, like, in recent, I don't know, months or years, what are the Japanese games that really stood out for you?
In recent years, okay, so yeah, I don't know how much I can go back, but all right. So I think
maybe let's stick to this generation of consoles and
to this generation. Oh, okay, so obviously, well, some of the games that we discussed a bit in our documentaries, through Ebb and Flow, for example, Nier Automata. Mm-hmm. Is a personal favorite of mine. Then I have to talk about The Last Guardian as well. In more recent, your question was this year, so I'll answer for this year. I think I played Yakuza 7, which I really enjoyed. It was quite interesting how the whole new approach to something more.
Yeah, because it's completely different, right?
Yeah. Neo 2 was a very good sequel as well to his predecessor, and I really enjoyed playing that till the end. I'll admit, full disclosure, I haven't got to play the Final Fantasy VII remake yet, so yeah. I won't be able to talk about it, but I'm looking forward to what else is gonna come this year, and there's the next generation right around the corner too, so I think at the end of the year I'll let you know again, like, what we enjoyed.
Yeah, definitely. So you thought already a bit about the future. So is there any, I would say, title or titles that you're really looking forward to see in the future, how they're going to be, how they're going to shape up?
Sure. So one example, let's see, Katsura Hashino's new game. Mm-hmm. So Project Re Fantasy.
Yeah.
Is something I'm really looking forward to. Don't have much info about it, but I'm really looking forward to it and to Hashino's take on fantasy. Mm-hmm. Next, a new Yoko Taro game. We saw announcements for a remake reboot of the Nier Replicant game, and also there's a new mobile Nier game. But yeah, but I think many of us are also looking forward to is a full-on new original console game from Yoko Taro.
Mm-hmm.
I'll admit a new Fumito Ueda game is something I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, because he's now gonna do it under, I would say, his own label outside of Sony, right? I think
with Gen Design, yes.
With Gen Design. I'm looking, I would say, forward to the project Appia, was it called? And the new, I would say,
Appia?
Yeah, the new Luminous Productions work.
Yep.
from Square
absolutely.
Enix. I think Elden
this
Ring
one looked very great, yeah.
Elden Ring, I think, also is something that I'm having a close eye on it. Not because of the book author, because actually I don't like the R.R. Martin books that much, but just like something very fresh from software is very, I would say, interesting. So those, I would say, are some of the titles that I have currently in my mind.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Yeah, so it's you're actually reminding me of those. So yeah, the Project Atia that was announced a couple of days ago was really interesting, and I would like to know more about that. Elden Ring, obviously. I'm a From Software fan myself, and I play almost all the games, so I was also excited to see the Demon's Soul remake too. So these are also Japanese League games I'm looking forward to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe with over an hour, I would say, of content here, I will not take more of you. I've enjoyed the interview very much. One part that I want to end with is very similar to how you were ending some of your videos. So I would like to ask you of one word that you particularly like, and because you were also asking some of the creators that question in your videos.
I've been asking that question myself quite a lot, so I'm just not used to have people ask it to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of closes the loop a bit, but to talk about the archipel name and mm-hmm. The archipel word and why we pick that as our new like identity is mm-hmm. Something so archipel means archipelago in French, and what we envisioned was having that place where you could isolate yourself, you know, and kind of have that that island, you know, those islands of mm-hmm. content that you could, where you could just go there and kind of be fully immersed into it. So we had, well, to be honest, we had built like a whole storyline with, we're working with illustrators on this as well. It got maybe a bit too complicated for us to fully showcase it. And
is it going to be an anime sometimes?
Oh, wow. That's quite a stretch. But hopefully, I don't know. It's something we can definitely think about, and we have ideas about this. But basically, the archipel word is really something that we had mm-hmm. in mind as where we wanted to place ourselves with our content, and what we wanted to make people kind of feel to like be in that island that's also kind of an archive where you could see the kind of records and of Japanese creators and Japanese artists, and be able to discover each of those words, each of those islands in a way, you know. So mm-hmm. that's
That's your word.
My one word. Yeah.
Great. Also awesome that we talked at the end about just the origin of the name. That's really good and a very good way to end this episode. So, Alex, thank you very much for being a guest, having a great discussion. I enjoyed, I would say, every sentence, every minute of it very much. It was a pleasure of having you here. And
yep, and sorry to the listeners for my French accent.
No, if they can cope with my Polish accent, they can cope with your French accent. So I think they will be fine. And just at the end, just to let you know, we are still in the Patreon, I would say, community waiting for that Ikumi Nakamura story. and what happened there?
We kind of all wonder like where she's at it, to be honest. But
yes, we're waiting. We're patient and we are waiting, and we're looking forward to see more videos from you guys. Of course, stay safe. Best of luck with everything you guys are doing. Expand the team if you want, and etc. So reach your goals. And yeah, so thank you very much again. And yeah, hopefully hear you someday, maybe either in person or again in audio later.
Sure. Thank you very much. And you stay safe and healthy as well. And hoping all listeners will enjoy our conversation.
I bet they will. So thank you. Thanks to you. Thanks to all of the listeners. See you guys. Bye.
Bye.